Hi, my name is Cole Soderlund. I'm a sophomore at Mamaroneck High School, and today I'm interviewing Myron Alexander about his father's service in World War II. His father's name is Lawrence Alexander. So I just want to start off with like your father's life like before the war.
Sure.
So like where did he grow up?
My father grew up in Detroit, Michigan, during the Depression. Mm-hmm. His father, Lawrence Sr., was a sharecropper. Had moved from the south up north into Detroit, worked in the factories in Detroit, and his mother was actually an English teacher.
Oh, really?
Yes, his mother was an English teacher, and he grew up, went to the local high schools there, attended his first year of college, I'm not sure where, and then he decided after that year he was going to enlist into the Marine Corps.
Nice. How many siblings do you have?
My father has one younger brother, three siblings, a younger brother, William. Mm-hmm. William actually went into the Army and served in World War II in the European theater. Mm-hmm. And then Martha and Adelaide, his two sisters.
Nice. What, like, brand, so, like, he served in the, so his brother, Will?
William.
William served in the Army. What did he do in the Army?
You know, I don't know exactly what Uncle Bill did in... And he was in a combat unit. I'm not sure what his mode of service was there, but he was in I think he was in Germany. I think when he was stationed.
Mm-hmm. So do you have like any like interesting stories about his time like in Detroit, or?
yes, I do. My father was actually very interested in medicine and theology. Believe it or not, and he loved chemistry. I thought it was kind of odd that this kid liked chemistry. He once told me, had a story, a standing story about my father, about a biology project he did. Mm-hmm. And he was trying to think about what he wanted to do for a biology project. So he went to the local pound, and at that time they would euthanize animals.
Yeah.
There. They weren't very benevolent. And he went to the pound, and he actually got an animal that had been euthanized, and he reconstructed the animal's anatomy.
How old was he?
He was around 16 or 17.
Wow.
Got an A.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My father was very meticulous on detail, even as a boy. Very mechanically inclined, could take things apart, put them back together. I think probably that was probably one of the saving graces when he did enlist into the Marine Corps, mm-hmm. Because very few of them had the kind of skill sets that he had. He had chemistry, and he was also a plumber's apprentice.
Yeah.
So he understood some things about, you know, how mechanical things worked, how to put them together, and he ended up in a very specific unit that was not exactly in the combat zone, but close enough to the combat zone because he was in charge of making sure fresh water and stuff could get into the combat theater.
Important, yeah.
Yeah, for wounds, for, you know, you need water no matter where you are.
For sure.
So that was, and he also, he liked drama. He was actually, I heard, a pretty good actor, a good orator. He won a few contests for his oratory skills. I guess that's why he later on, as a minister, he did so well.
Yeah.
But, yes.
So like obviously like, there was discrimination in America in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm.
Like what discrimination, and still today there's a little bit, but
sure.
What discrimination did he face like in Detroit before joining?
Wow. So I think one of the things that he talked about most was when he was in school, there was, you know, there were poor neighbors, people of all racial backgrounds and ethnicities. But, you know, poverty doesn't know no race. You know?
Yeah.
So, I remember a story he told me when he was in a drama club. They had a play, and apparently he stole the show. And people were just so taken by him, and they decided to have a party afterwards. And they were having it at this place on the other side of town. And when he got there with the rest of his friends, which were white, he was told, "You can't come in."
Oh.
And so he came home.
That's awful.
Yeah. So that kind of struck him, and then when he got a little bit older, well, after he graduated from high school into college, I think he really wanted to pursue medicine. There weren't very many avenues for black children or African Americans to go to school and pursue that. Most of his friends went to work in factories, got odd jobs. And I think he was kind of lonesome. And he decided, you know what, I want to get out of this place. And he enlisted.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good story. Well, not a good one, but.
You never know what happens like to motivate someone to take a step. Sometimes it's some kind of extreme discomfort or some other kind of situation that propels them in another direction. So that's exactly, I believe, what happened with my father.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why did he, I gotta ask, why did he choose the Marine Corps instead of, say, the Army or the Navy or any other branch?
That is very interesting. That's a very interesting question. Good question. We often wondered about that. I think when my father went in, I really felt like he wanted to do something that very few had done before. And I think the Marine Corps appealed to him because at that time, even with most people of color in that time, and even now, the military is a source, is an avenue for you to kind of get away from not just where you grew up, but to see the rest of the country and the rest of the world.
For sure, yeah.
And I think that's what appealed to him. I'm sure he didn't know what he was signing up for.
Going to see the country and the world doesn't really seem like it fits when we're in the middle of a huge world war.
Right, right. But then you have to also realize, too, at that time, a lot of the people at that were in very impoverished conditions. And the military, when you're enlisted, the military does, to a good extent, take care of you.
Yeah.
Of course, you sacrifice your life, potentially. But that was one of the pathways to getting out, getting an income, and seeing the world.
Plus, you also get the GI Bill.
You get the GI Bill, and you get some kind of technical training.
Yeah.
So I think that's really what he was after. I don't think he really knew when he crossed over into Camp Lejeune, because at that time the African Americans did not go to Camp Lejeune, not to Mumford Point.
Okay.
I don't think he knew exactly what he was in store for him. And he was in the 52nd Defense Battalion, so there was only one other group that came before him.
The 51st
Artillery Division.
Okay.
The 51st Artillery Division was actually, from what he told me, was outstanding. They never lost in a drill. They outscored everyone.
Wow.
But turns out, just before they shipped out, they had a skirmish on the base with the 51st. And they broke them up and they shipped them off.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
So he told a story about being a new recruit, being in the barracks, and then literally a firefight broke out.
Wow.
And he said there were bullets flying everywhere. And it was because of the way they were being treated.
Mm.
And that 51st, they had an uprising. And that's when they were thinking, this Black Marine thing is not going to work.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he talked about that, being scared to death and thinking, what am I doing here? And then they made it through basic training, which he said was... He would often say sometimes, somebody say, that person would go to hell. He says, I've been there before. And he says, basic training was just that. He said the treatment for the black soldiers was not particularly good. They trained extremely hard. At one point, I think there was a fire at a munitions depot.
Mm-hmm.
And they were required to go and suppress that and clean it up. He said, so bullets and everything were flying and things were in flames. And he said they fought that for a couple of days, I believe.
Yeah, even though they weren't trained as firefighters.
No. That didn't matter.
Wow.
He often talked about, how long the days were, and sometimes he felt like they weren't being fed enough. But he made it through. He made it through.
It's impressive.
Yeah.
I gotta ask, what did his friends and family feel about his decision to join the Corps and not go into factory or a job?
That was interesting. Yeah, my grandfather, as I said, was a sharecropper. And I think at that time, they also saw the military as a route out of the community. Hmm. I don't think he particularly, my grandmother or my grandfather knew what he was in store for. My grandfather, as I said, worked in the factory, and it was interesting because my grandfather only had three fingers on one hand. And part of the reason why he left the South was when he was a little boy working in the fields, he slipped and fell with an axe and cut two of his fingers off. And so at that point, he said, you know, I'm not going to work in the fields. I'm not going to work for these people anymore.
Yeah.
And he migrated and he worked in the factory. But even though he worked in the factory, like typical during that point in our history, even when he got paid and worked, he couldn't shop and get groceries in certain places. He would have to cross the border to Canada to get you know, certain meats and things like that that blacks could not get quality food. So he would leave on a Friday, go to Canada, you know, get what he had to do and come back. But he planted and grew everything right there in the yard. He had like a little quarter acre. And my grandfather could grow anything, and my grandmother could can anything you can think of. So they did quite well. But I think when he decided he was going to go into the military, they understood it. But as I said, I'm sure they didn't understand what he signed up for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You mentioned like how everyone, like your father, your grandfather, your grandmother, none of them knew what he was signing up for. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that was? Or did they have such a phantasmal view of the military?
Well, I think that, you know, my grandmother being in education, I think she wanted him to pursue his education. I just think that also the money wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, that's one of the biggest, even nowadays, that's one of the big driving factors for that type of decision being made. And so he went, they didn't argue with him. My grandfather was the very old school, that once you got around 18 years old, you're ready to leave, and you're a man, and you make your own decision, and God bless you, and, you know, do the best you can. So, he went on, and as I said, his younger brother William followed right behind him, and then went into the army.
Yeah. So now I kind of want to talk about his like time, like while he was in training at Camp Lejeune.
Mm-hmm.
So, when did he learn that he was going to be in a separate segregated unit, or did he expect that, knowing about the Marine Corps at the time?
He did not. I don't believe he did know that. When they got there, I remember him. Although he knew racism and had, you know, suffered the ills of racism at home, I just don't believe when he got there, it was so stark and so, you know, brazen.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was shocked. Because even as Marines, there were places those Marines could not go off base.
Yeah.
So he was shocked by that. I think he was also, he talked about, one of the things was the cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
He said he couldn't believe, you know, the things that people saw and accepted as okay.
Mm-hmm.
And even within the Marine Corps at the time, he couldn't believe, you know, even with their training regimen, the things that they had to go through was still even more difficult than the other Marines, and they weren't even on the same base.
Yeah.
You know, which I think led to part of the uprising with the 51st, was part of the treatment that they had. But he had no idea what he was walking into. And I think the other thing that really bothered him was when he got there, it was a combination of how the white officers treated them, but also how some of the black drill instructors treated him as well. And he just could not, for some reason, reconcile how some of that stuff took place. I remember his drill instructor was a very famous retired sergeant major named Huff. Huff was around 6'6".
So you heard that name.
Sergeant Major Huff. Big guy, ended up serving in Vietnam, I think Korea. I mean, he was a career Marine as well. And Huff really, really worked those guys. Mm-hmm. He said the training was just cruel. Was cruel. And so he often said, you know, some of the things they made them do in terms of their training, and like I said, you know, well into the night, all night, you know, not much to eat. He said the sleeping, the barracks conditions were not that great. He couldn't understand why, I guess he felt like those officers should have advocated for them. And it turns out, I think there was one white commanding officer who really advocated for him. I think in one of the letters he wrote, he said that, I can't remember that officer's name, he says, he's really gone an extra mile for us to make sure we get enough to eat and that kind of thing. But that was, I think that's one of the things.
Was Huff white? Or?
No, Huff was black.
Huff was black. Yeah.
Okay. Hashmark, was Hashmark Johnson, they call him Hashmark because I think he came from the Army before he came to the Marine Corps. I think was in the Army, Army and the Navy, and the Marine Corps, I think, was the third part of his career. Hashmark Johnson, they call him. And then he had one group. He had the 51st. And then Huff had my father's group, the 52nd. And he said he was a big, tough guy. I mean, at that point in history, I knew you probably are very familiar, Ms. Northrup, is that there was a thing at the Marines call it hands-off training. So hands-off basically meant that nowadays the drill instructors can't really put their hands on. Hands-on, when my father and brother were in the Marine Corps, they would beat you up. And so some guys are really beaten. I mean, guys almost drown. I mean, it's bad. Not unusual, he said, for one of the enlisted men to be beaten by the officers.
Yes. Your grandfather was from the South, so I'm assuming that your father probably heard some stories about how the South is probably more racially segregated than the North. Mm-hmm. And so did that prepare him for, say, like when he went off base in North Carolina, or was he still surprised by the racism he experienced?
I think it's one of those situations where you're aware of it, but you're never ready for the depths of it. Like, just like you hear a lot of people serving the military say, you train for combat, but actual combat and training for combat is like two different things.
Yes.
He was aware of racism. He was aware of what his father had gone through, because his father is one of 10 children. Five girls and five boys. And so, you know, there was many stories about, you know, what had happened in the South. It was also one of the things that propelled my grandfather to move North. But even with that and what my father experienced growing up, I just don't believe that he was ready for what he was about to witness and be exposed to when he went back South. Because he was actually born in North, so he was kind of, although he heard the stories, he was kind of removed. But when he went back South and saw it firsthand, it was a shocker.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned how your father had special skills before he went to the military. Mm-hmm. Did the military pick up on those skills and give him specialized training, or did he just go with it?
No, exactly. That's a great question. Yes, they realized when they got there, I think a lot of the guys who enlisted may have made it in through high school to just about the high school. He had a year of college. And so then when they realized he understood chemistry, he understood some of the basic of plumbing, they immediately pulled him aside and they said, we're going to put you in a small group of engineers. And you're going to work strictly on working with our desalinization equipment and learning how to deploy it, clean it, move it, do everything you have to do. So it was him and one of his buddies. He always talked about by the name of T.S. Houston. Mm-hmm. The two of them worked what they called the water point. Wherever they were, whatever island they were deployed on, they were required to set up these units at the forward operating base, make sure that everything was running. The base had plenty of water, and any Marines coming in from other theaters could you know, come in, yeah, and get the water. So he did go through specialized training, I think it, in a certain respect, I think it may have been saved.
Why you say that?
Well, you know, a lot of the pointers are on islands, although they said there were no Japanese or anything left on the island, there were still people on the island, there were still combatants on the island.
I'm sure. And the Japanese never surrendered.
And they did not surrender, they were dug in. And my father said, when we hit the island, they said they were gone, but he says they were there because he said at night when we were working the water point, you can hear, you know, people scurrying up there trying to get ammunition or water, whatever they could get, and they knew they were there. But the other good part about it was, because he had this specialized skill set and been trained, he and his buddy Houston had like a 12-hour shift.
Oh, wow.
So they had to make sure the machine was manned, it was running, and then every now and then the machine had to be broken down, cleaned, you know, and then set back up. But while it was broken down, they still had to make sure there was enough water in reserve so nobody coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
Had supplies of water. So, two things that I think used to get to the commanding officers with my father in Houston, and Ms. Northrop, you probably know about this. In the military, if you're in uniform, you have to salute a commanding officer.
Okay.
So, when they worked on the water point, they were never in full uniform. They just had on their pants and their boots.
Yeah,
you could. No shirts on. And so the commanding officers walked by and everybody stopped their attention. He would just keep working. Commanding officers didn't like that.
Or didn't like that.
No. They expect that those black soldiers, no matter what you were doing, you better stop what you're doing and recognize that officer. So I think part of my father's rebellious streak was like, you know, I'm not going to recognize this guy. I got something to do, and I'm going to get my work done. I just stayed working on them. And so he said a couple of times when they would go through these alternating, you know, shifts with his buddy, when the troops had to get up and, you know, start the day, he would be going to bed.
Oh, wow.
And he said one of the commanding officers came in and said, who the heck is that, you know what, still in the bunk? Get him up and get him outside and get him working. And the other commander says, no. You leave him alone. He says, those two are keeping us alive. You let them sleep. They've been working all night. Leave them alone. He's like, why? He says, see those machines out there? They're keeping everything running. They work 12-hour shifts. They're done until it's time to eat. They're off.
Wow. So they had some support there.
Yeah, because they, you know, you only got two guys. If you lose one, you're kind of stuck. But then even with that, my father was a big swimmer. He's actually a long distance swimmer. He loved to swim. He loved the water.
Good place to be stationed for that.
Yeah. So it was funny. He used to tell the stories about having to clean the filters on the ship, because the ships would also take water in, and they had to be clean. And I don't know what I had watched on television as a boy, but I think it was maybe the movie with Cuba Gooding when he was the Navy diver. I'm not sure what movie it was. And I said, Dad, so you had to put on those tanks and you had to go underneath the ship and take the... And he looked at me in kind of bewilderment, like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you know, you said you had to go under the ship. He goes, no. We stripped down. They gave us a surfboard. We put our tools on the surfboard. We paddled out to the ship.
That's ridiculous.
We put a mask on. We put our tools around our waist, and we free dove and went down and did it by hand.
That's insane.
He says no air tanks for you guys. Get down there and get it done. He said, hope that somebody doesn't turn on the machine and ship, because it was sucking.
Oh my God! Yeah, yeah.
Into the ship. So, you know, I was always amazed at how long he could swim. I was just like, are you ever going to get... He goes, you know, this is what I used to do. We'd paddle out. And he said, sometimes he said, we'll get out there and there'll be some sharks in the water or something. Jeez. And you got to just let them go by. And then we take turns. He said, we alternate. We drop our tools at the bottom of the lagoon, put a wire on them. And we would take turns diving and taking the stuff apart, cleaning it, and putting it back.
Wow. I mean, it seemed like it would be a lot more efficient to keep them in the tanks.
Yeah, well, it would have been, but they felt, I guess they felt they weren't deserving of it.
Jeez.
They weren't trained for it, so you know what? You guys just make it happen.
Wow.
And they did.
Yeah. So now talking about like his experience in combat and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So like how long did it take for him to ship out after he finished training?
Well, it was a standard Marine Corps training. I think there was about three or four months
mm-hmm.
Training. Then he went to the West Coast, I believe, at Pendleton.
Okay.
They were at Pendleton for a few weeks.
Yeah.
And then they were deployed. They were deployed right after. I have to look at some of the letters he wrote to my grandmother, but I'm almost certain they were not there very long, right after basic training.
Yeah.
Before they were deployed. It was probably less than 2 months before they were actually out in the combat arenas.
So where did he serve? I mean, I know he served in Pacific Theater, but like, what, do you know? Like,
he was in the Marshall Islands, a place called Eniwetok Islands.
Okay.
So they would kind of move around wherever the ships were needed, and they would set up a base. He would move around there and set up. So he was in the Marshalls for a good portion of that time. I know that when they got to one of the islands, they still had some combatants. Some of the Japanese were still on the island.
Yeah.
And even with that, they managed to hit the beach and set up a forward operating base in 72 hours.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, and he said the general hit the island and said, how long is it going to take these Marines to get this thing set up? And the guy says, we're running. He said, you're kidding me. They're up and running. 72 hours that they got the other combatants firing off away from where they want to set up, secure the area,
wow.
And set the base up.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
So, like, what role did he serve in combat? Like, so some examples of that is combat support, and combat service support.
He was, I would say, combat service support.
Okay.
The thing is, as I said, because of his skill set, they kept him close enough to the arena.
Not actually fighting.
Because actually, that's a valuable target. Anywhere
yeah.
your ammunition is, where your water is, that's a very valuable target.
Yeah.
If you knock that out,
if you knock the water out, you can't fight.
You disable the rest
mm-hmm.
of the Marines. But at the same time, he still had guard duty. They still had patrols on the areas where they were stationed. I remember a funny story when we went to the Montfort Point Marine ceremony. My father was sitting at a chair, and there were two other gentlemen sitting to the left and right of him. Who were also Montfort Point Marines, and so they started to talk, have a conversation. They didn't really know each other. The guy says, well, who are you with? And he says, I was with the 52nd. And he said, I was in the Marshalls at such and such island. And he says, I ran the water point. And the guy looked, and he said, you? And he goes, yeah. He goes, I'm the guy who relieved you when you left. And he said, what? He says, yeah, when you guys left, they sent us, and we picked up where you guys left off. And he says, you know, they said it wasn't a combat zone. And my father said, they told you it wasn't a combat zone. He said, those guys, the place was crawling. He said, what do you mean? He said, they cleared them out. He said, they told me they cleared everybody out. The guy sitting over to the other side, my father says, well, I came before you. He said, and we couldn't get them all. He said, we got as many as we could. He said, but, you know, then we had to ship out and you guys came in. So
yeah.
It was interesting to see. It was,
like,
oddly enough,
world, yeah.
Those three guys who had been in the same place around the same time.
Yeah.
And see that kind of continuum of what had gone on. But, yeah, he said they often had to go out and, you know, make sure that they weren't close enough to actually do any damage to the
operating base. It's pretty clear that clearing up the Japanese was not really a viable option considering, like, one just came out of the Philippine jungle after like 75 years.
Right, exactly, exactly, exactly. So that was an interesting story that they told.
Yeah. So I know he became a reverend after the service.
Mm-hmm.
So how did religion affect him in his time of service? And did his time, during that time, did his faith strengthen or weaken? Or
I believe it strengthened tremendously. My grandmother was very religious.
Okay.
And some of the letters he wrote constantly back and forth to my grandmother, his mom. And, you know, I think he understood, or his faith was strengthened because of the things he had seen, not just, you know, as growing up as a young black man,
mm-hmm.
But as he went through basic training, as he saw what went on in the Marine Corps,
yeah.
And when he was deployed, you know, it strengthened his religion, his resolve. I mean, you talked about some of the things, asked the question previously about, you know, some of the discrimination they faced there. And even in the Marine Corps, he said some of the natives came to them and said, "We were told you guys were monkeys that were trained to do this stuff. And you have on pants because you have tails."
Yeah.
He said, "What?" And so this is right within the ranks.
That's incredible.
This was in the ranks, this was going on. So I think that really all that he had experienced during that time, and even coming home after the military, his military service, definitely strengthened his faith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So did his opinions about the country and segregation change during his time in the military as well, or not really?
I think he had a broader and deeper understanding of how entrenched racism really was.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of the things he talked about, you know, to us as children, growing up well into his, you know, into his 80s, what he experienced. My father was an avid reader, always read the paper, always watched the news. Mm-hmm. I mean, nothing got past him. He would just, one of his favorite things to do when you came in from school, he would ask you about some current event, and you wouldn't know what he was talking about. He would look at you like, "Wow, how come you don't know?"
Yeah, yeah.
I think his awareness became even more acute. But also, as you, I may not have mentioned, he was also a social worker as well.
Oh, no.
Yeah, if I was a minister, a social worker, and a professor.
How many jobs did he
have? he did them all, believe Jeez. It or not. He was a professor at the University of Houston in social work. He was a professor at the University of Buffalo. In social work, he ran community centers in some of the roughest neighborhoods in the Northeast, up in Buffalo, New York. And I think the things he experienced really drove him down that path. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I know he was as you said, he worked with the water. Did that change at all during the course of the war, or did he just simply go to different bases?
No, it did not change. He just went to different locations.
Mm-hmm.
I guess for whatever reason, the military did not do a lot of training of new personnel.
Yeah, yeah.
So that the entire time, 2.5 years he was there, that was his what they call MOS. That's what he did. He and his buddy. And they did not train anybody else until, I guess, wherever else they trained back at the base.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's who relieved him. But his MOS did not change for the entire time he was there.
That's kind of interesting. Yeah.
It's interesting. I found it interesting because, you know, typically they say, you know, Marines are fighting personnel first and foremost. But then when you think about it, how many other things are vitally important that have to happen
exactly.
in order to be combat ready?
Yeah.
And I never thought about that until, you know, talking to my father and the things that they had to do and know. Then it made more sense to me.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. But like obviously, like they had relations with soldiers from white units and the combat units during mm-hmm. his time. How did those relations work? And how did
not well. Not well. He often talked about some of the white Marines would hit the island, coming to, you know, get their water supplies, and you know, his water supplies, ammunition depot, all those things were there, and so there was a lot of tension there because they felt like, you know, you're here to serve us.
Okay.
And so they would do a lot of, you know, things. They would come in and just pull up a truck and just kick all the water containers off onto the ground, tell them, you know, pick them up and get them, you know, fill them. And my father was like, you know, he was like, some of those guys were not very bright. But, he had been to college. He goes, you can't just put water in the jug and get it back. These things have to be sterilized. I mean, all these things have to happen.
Yeah.
And so he was really annoyed by that. There was a palpable tension between them. Even though we're in the combat zone, there was still a tension about what their roles were and how valuable one was. Although they had a singular mission, that was...
Yeah, there was obviously racial mm-hmm. tension.
And even on base, on Montford Point, a few times when they, especially with the 51st, I believe, artillery division, mm-hmm. they were so good, no one ever beat them or outscored them in the matches.
You mentioned that,
And they didn't like it. It was okay. It was a sore, it was a very sore
getting beat
spot.
Is never fun.
Yeah, but they never beat them.
Yeah.
And it came to a point, I believe my father said, the 51st was actually so good until at those days they used to fly a plane with like a trailer of a dummy plane behind it, they had to shoot at it.
Yeah.
He said the 51st was so good until they wouldn't shoot at the dummy plane, they would shoot at the wire and clip the wire and just take the whole dummy down.
Jeez.
And the general got so upset about how cocky they were, he was like, let's get them off the field, just take them off the range.
Why? Even though
he was like, well, they're not going to make us look bad. And
wow.
So they took him off the range.
Jeez. It's
incredible. It really is. I don't know how he made it, how he survived it. But you know, he did. And a lot of men just like him made it through.
Yeah.
You know.
So did your father earn any medals other than the Medal of Honor that was given to him by Obama?
He has some medals, you know, it's interesting, he never talked about any medals he was awarded. I believe there were some, and I have to go back through the military records to find uh-huh. them.
Yeah.
Some were sent in a box to us. I'm not sure exactly what all of them stood for.
Yeah.
But quite often, even like my brother who served in the Marine Corps after my father, never smoked much about any kind of accolades or anything that they had encountered, which is, I guess, typical. Well, I guess when you see those kind of things, medals don't mean much.
No, of course.
You lose people, bad things happen, you just...
Piece of metal isn't...
Yeah.
Yeah.
They didn't talk about it much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So where was he when the war ended?
When he came back to the United States?
No, when the war, like, when it announced that Japan surrendered.
I believe he was in... I want to say he was in Guam.
Guam.
He was in Guam. And I actually have some things for you to look at there. When they announced it was over. And he was going to be coming home. He didn't come straight home. I think he went to somewhere like Iowa, North Dakota or something. I said, Dad, how did you end up there? He said, I wasn't ready to go home. Took some little part-time jobs. I worked a little bit. And then he finally came, found his way back home. I believe he was in Guam.
I gotta ask, how did he celebrate when he heard that news?
You know, that's interesting. He never said he celebrated as much. I remember him saying, thank God that's over.
Really?
Like he was just ready to get away from it.
It wasn't much of a celebrate as much as simply like happy that it's done.
It was done. You know, he made it through it. I'm sure he knew of many guys who did not make it.
I'm sure, yeah.
And so he, I think it was more of a relief than it was a celebration for him. I'm sure my grandmother celebrated.
Yeah.
Her son was coming home and he made it. No, I think at that point he was planning and thinking about how he was going to get back to the, what they call the real world and continue his life and his education.
Now I want to talk about like his time after the war and like kind of what he did then.
Mm-hmm.
So, or how does the time in the Marines like kind of like affect his relationships with like civilians once he got home?
I remember my father saying, and I guess it's a part of that whole military, the Marine Corps training, basic training. He said, you know, when you come through basic training, it's just so angry.
Yeah.
You know, he says, you know, I think I like hated the world at that time. He said, just the things that they put us through. He said, I just didn't like, you know, anybody or anything.
Sure.
I think once he got out, he made it through it. I think he was more thankful. He had made it through it. And he was, my father was always wanting to be around when he did finally make it home to help his mother and his father. Always around, you know, the family. And at that time, I think when he came home on a leave before, he saw my mother. He hadn't met her. And discovered he liked her. He said, if I hadn't met your mother, he said, I might have went back and stayed in the Marine Corps. But so he found my mother, and they got married. And then he started a family. He went to school during that time and worked.
Where did he go to school?
He ended up going to Wayne State University. He played football at Wayne State. He went to the Detroit Bible Institute. He became a minister, and then I'm trying to figure out where he did his master's work. It won't come to me right now, but I remember him talking about being up late at night driving from work to school, back home, sleeping a couple hours, and going back to work.
Yeah.
So he said lots of black coffees, driving all night, lots of black coffee.
5-hour energy wasn't around yet.
No,
either.
None of that. Just black coffee. No cream, very little sugar. Just drink the coffee and go. I said, okay. So he made it happen.
Nice.
Yeah.
So was he ever a member of the Montfort Point Marine Association?
Yes, he was. Unfortunately, he had gotten to the point where his health began to fail, so he couldn't really make appointments and meetings.
Yeah.
And he kept his membership. He got periodic, notifications of things going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was, the last event was the dedication of the ship in San Diego, the USNS Montfort Point, which is the first, it was called the MLP-1, first in class, multiple landing platform, which is, really is. It's a supply ship.
Kind of symbolizing what they did.
But this ship was really incredible because it can do everything while still at sea.
Jeez.
So imagine a ship with a middle portion that could actually submerge.
Oh, wow.
So amphibious machine.
Makes sense.
Could come aboard. They can do all the repairs on it.
That's
you
incredible.
Can deploy anything from it. I think they said it can generate enough power to light, like, 10 or 15 New York City blocks.
Wow.
It's like a floating city.
It's like a movie.
Yeah. It was really incredible. We couldn't go aboard. I stood in for him at that ceremony.
Yeah.
I guess because some of the engineering and everything was state of the art. No one was supposed to see it.
Yeah, makes sense.
But those who did go aboard, who were cleared to go aboard, said when you got on it and climbed to the highest point, they could see Tijuana.
Oh, wow.
From the top of the ship.
Jeez.
From San Diego.
Big ship.
And he says that it only took less than 40 personnel to run that entire ship.
Wow.
It was all state of the art, everything. So I did get a chance to stand in and see that and tell him about it. He was impressed. He's like, it doesn't have to land? I said, no, it doesn't have to. It never has to come to the shore. really? I said, never. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So you mentioned that your father, like, when his health failed, he was no longer able to attend stuff. So before his health was failing him, does that mean that he like contributed to the association and attended events and everything?
I think he attended meetings. I don't know how many events. I don't recall him actually going to, but then again, maybe I was not there at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I took him to Washington, D.C. I traveled with him. He couldn't move around that well. But I did believe he attended meetings at the Manhattan chapter, I think it was. And might have been in Harlem, I believe.
Did he ever attend the annual convention at the Montford Point Maria Museum?
Oh, no, he did not. But I loaned his dress greens to the museum. His greens are in the museum.
Okay. Oh, wow.
His greens are in the museum. His ID that I took photographs is there. Some other artifacts, some that he brought home, are in the museum.
Nice.
Where is the museum?
It's Camp Johnson.
Oh.
It's now called Camp Johnson. After Hashmark Johnson, that was the first, yeah, and it's in North Carolina.
How often did he meet up with his unit, and like, did he form like many lifelong bonds? That you would you say, or not really?
Well, you know, that's interesting. That's a very good question. His buddy Houston, they fell out of contact with one another, never were able to locate each other again. You know, that was one of the things that my father was always fascinated about, this whole thing with, you know, social media and Facebook.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, man, if I could just find some of the guys, you know, some of the, but that wasn't their era, you know.
Yeah.
So he didn't.
Kind of went separate ways.
Yeah, they went their separate ways. And I know one or two of the guys said after they finished that they were going to go back to the islands and not come back to the Saints.
Really?
They said they didn't want to come back.
Wow.
So I don't know if any of them ever did that, but he said, that was a conversation they would often have. Like they, you know, he says, as bad as it seemed to be when you're in the combat zone, he said there was a certain amount of freedom to it.
Yeah, yeah, that you didn't get in the States.
And you couldn't get in the States. And I think that was that's a common story when you hear about the African-American GIs who were in European theater.
Well, sure,
a lot of
yeah.
them stayed in France, and they stayed in London, in England.
Yeah.
They just didn't want to come back.
Makes sense.
They felt that it was more accepting for them.
It probably was at the time,
And so they stay.
Yeah. So, like, how many kids do you have? How many siblings do you have?
I've got a brother and two sisters.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm the youngest of four. Like I said, my brother followed my father, who's in the Marine Corps, served in Vietnam. And then I have two sisters who are professional people.
Nice. Yeah. Do you have any, like, interesting stories from your childhood?
About
like relating like times with your father, experiences.
Oh yeah, I have a lot of those. As I said, my father was a professor, and he was always teaching. Mm-hmm. My father had a firm belief that no matter what happened to you, you're supposed to learn something from it.
Yeah.
So one of his favorite things to do, and I always thought as a kid he had the absolute worst timing, because you have experiences you thought was like awful, and you tell him about it, and he'd say, so what did we learn from this? And I would say, not now, I don't want to have that conversation. He says, well, you know, if you didn't learn anything from it, chances are, you know, it's probably going to happen again. And he would go through this whole rationale, and it's like, Dad, I don't want to have that conversation with you now. But he was always teaching. So one of the favorite stories he had was, we would often have projects together around the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one afternoon, he was saying to me, you know, we have a project to do tomorrow. And I said, okay. And he said, what is it? He says, we have to clean all the gutters. At the time, we lived in Buffalo, New York. We had a pretty large house in Buffalo. And we had done this project before. And so I think, okay, we're gonna do this project. Lo and behold, I get all the tools together. I get the buckets. I get the ladders. And so he says to me, you're going to start over here at this corner, work your way around. When you get to the next corner, go up that side and then come back down on the other end. He said, and my father was big on time. It should probably take you, he said, 3.5-4 hours.
Yeah.
And I just looked at him and I said, me? He says, yeah, you know how to do this. I got some other business to take care of. So you handle it. I'll come back and check when you're done. And I was like, are you kidding me? I did it. I did it, of course, not too happy you stuck me with that job by myself. And of course, at dinner time, what was the conversation? So what did we learn from this? And, you know, believe it or not, you know, it's you are always tested. You're going to have situations that, I think the metaphor, the larger story is, you're going to be put in situations where you have to take control and handle the situation. And you're going to make some mistakes along the way, but you won't really know what your potential is until you go and you go out and do it. And so that was like a recurring kind of theme to all of our little projects and things my father would give me to do. Because after, once we lived in Buffalo, we then moved to Westchester County. And he actually lived in Westchester a year before we moved here. Okay. He had taken a job with the United Church of Christ. They were trying to help him find a home. I was just getting into high school at the time. And so he left me with a long laundry list of things that need to be done around the house in his absence while I was with with my mom.
Yeah.
My brothers and sisters were all 5 years apart, so I'm the youngest, and so I was left with it. They had all left home. So, believe it or not, you know, after a few months of trying to figure things out, I pretty much had it done. I could run the house at 14 pretty much on my own. You know, he came back and he was like, not bad, you know.
Impressive.
Yeah, he's like, not bad. Okay, I wouldn't have done it that way, but, you know. But after a year of doing it, I was like, oh, okay, I can really make this house. I can get things done. Did you check the water? Did you check the boiler? Did you, on the bills page? Did you drop the bills off? You get done.
Nice.
Done.
Yeah. So where in Westchester did you guys move to?
We moved to Mount Vernon, New York,
okay.
Right on the borderline of Pelham,
okay.
Area called Oakwood Heights.
Okay.
As I said, before that, we lived in Buffalo.
Yeah, yeah.
And before that, we lived in Texas. So we're from Detroit to Buffalo to Texas, back to Buffalo, then to Mount Vernon.
A lot of places.
Yeah.
What did your father do in Mount Vernon?
My father was, he was a liaison, he was the head of what they call the Metropolitan Missions for the United Church of Christ.
Okay. Yeah.
So his role was to be kind of liaison between all of the churches, churches of color that were members of the United Church of Christ in all five boroughs.
Okay. Oh, wow.
So he would go to various churches and he would give a sermon sometime. Sometime he would just be there to meet with a group of pastors about what some of their concerns are about their churches, their parishioners, what kind of support the organization could loan to their church, and work on, you know, on their behalf to make sure those things happen. So he did that up until close to his retirement.
So what would you like people to remember from your father's story?
Wow.
It's a hard question.
You know, when I told my father that that it was true that they were getting this award from the president, he looked at me in kind of bewilderment. He shook his head and he goes, "I didn't think people knew who we were."
Wow.
He said, "I didn't think." He's like, "I remember saying, are you sure?" And I was like, "Dad, I'm looking at it. I found it online." And he goes, he said, all this time later, and she said, really? And I said, yeah, Dad. So from that, and the way he spoke, you know, I think for me personally, when I look at any kind of adverse condition, stumbling blocks, anything I run into, I look at those pictures and I think, you know what? There's some people that came before us, irregardless of their gender, their racial descriptor, ethnicity, religion, who've endured some things that are far worse than we'll ever probably can imagine.
Yeah.
And so with that, you know, I think it's always important for the stories to be told.
Yeah.
It's up to the individual to pick and choose a story they want to listen to or learn more about. But I think most of all, I think that what I think I would like for people to remember is this group of men were a key component of our American history and a part of a core group of people who really made what we call the Marine Corps what it is.
Yeah.
Because if they had not endured and made it, the Marine Corps was ready to say, we're not taking any people.
Yeah, no,
they wouldn't have taken any women, they wouldn't take anybody. So, you know, somebody had to make the sacrifice. He did. He endured it. He lived through it. And, you know, I would like people to know, you know, these stories do exist, and they're worth looking into.
Yeah.
And hopefully they can draw from it what they will. Hopefully they'll draw some kind of inspiration from it. But that's really, you know, what I think I like for people to know.
Yeah.
And thus me giving the interview.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So on top of that, is there anything that you would like to add that you didn't get to mention so far?
Anything to add? I don't believe so. I think you're a pretty thorough interviewer.
Thank you.
We do want to go back to the Congressional Medal of Honor, though. So how did you find out about, can you tell us again, how you found out about the Congressional Medal of Honor being awarded to your father?
Yes. So my friend, Will Brown, actually his father, Will Sr., and my father were pastors at the church together.
Okay.
And so Will and I grew up like brothers
from
first grade. And so Will was the one who told me after we reconnected on Facebook, he says, he's a career Marine. He says, I'm pretty sure your father's getting the Congressional Medal of Honor. And I said, really? And he sent me the link. And that's how this whole thing got going. I probably wouldn't have known.
Wow.
If I had never reconnected with him on Facebook, and we never had that conversation, this poor thing would probably have went right by me as well.
Yeah.
So you took your dad. You ended up taking your dad.
Yes. It's pretty. The reach of the American government is really astounding.
Yeah.
I mean, for someone to call you on the phone on your cell phone, and then tell you, okay, by tomorrow we're gonna wire money into your account to pay for this money. It was just pretty weird. I was like, oh. What the government can do, but they had it all laid out.
Awesome.
Room, everything was taken care of, and that made me feel good.
That's nice,
yeah. Because he really felt like, well, you know, I served, and
they finally showed him the respect he deserved.
So, how many recipients were they at this ceremony?
There were around, I want to say around a little over 300.
Wow.
There was, I believe, in total, from the period of month appointment, there was 20,000.
Yeah.
And they were just trying to figure out at that point how many of them were still alive.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so they were pretty surprised. And then it really surprised that my father, being that one of those first two groups, was still alive. Because even amongst the Montfort Point Marines, they were like, oh, you're one of the originals. Like,
yeah.
You came in when the proving grounds first opened. And he said, yeah. And I said, oh, my God. Even other older Marines would say, how was that? And he was shaking his head, man, you didn't want to be there. He said, you didn't want to be there when those proving grounds opened. Signed up for.
Wow.
What do you think prompted Obama to make this decision and to decide to make these awards?
I think, like himself, like President Obama, he was the first, of course. I think he wanted to let the country know that this contribution had been made by this group of men who were first, and that the country needed to recognize it. And I think really that was the impetus behind him wearing the medal. And it meant a lot to my father to be awarded the medal from the first African American president.
Sure, yeah.
Right.
That was it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Great ending to that story. Yeah,
yeah, for sure.
So do you have anything else you wanted to?
I don't think I do. Do you have anything else?
I can't think of anything more.
I'm available. If you have anything you want written down, you know, you can call me, email me.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much, Myron.
Thank you.
Your dad really was an outstanding. It's interesting to me, though. I'm sort of thinking the same way he's thinking. After all this time, it took this long to recognize. At the same time, as you say, it was so much better coming from the first African American president.
Yeah, really. You know, and the sad thing was that Obama physically couldn't be there at the ceremony. He did like a video thing of it, so he was a little disappointed.
Obama wanted to be there.
And you know, also Mayor Dinkins, the former mayor of New York City.
Yes.
He's appointed.
Yes, saw that in the book.
And
yeah,
he's a pointer as well.
Yeah.
So, but there's some things that I brought for you to look at in case you wanted to. If you have any questions or fill in any blanks, or so here's just one of the publications, and here's, I believe, in the end here is I know he's in there. My father was not very fond of Sergeant Major Huff, but. The drill instructor, he did not.
I'm sure.
That was not one of his favorite people.
Yeah.
But he was a great big guy. There he is. A Sergeant Major Huff.
Oh, wow. So going back to Huff, now that you mention him, did he ever end up respecting Huff or, like, trying to build him up at all? Or did he always prevent him?
You know, he didn't like Huff because he thought Huff was really cruel.
Yeah.
But he said... He did know that they were far better prepared than any of those other Marines ever were. He was confident that we're better trained, and you know, I imagine, you know, the training was a lot worse for him. I remember him saying, you know, some of the drills, the ammunition was live.
Oh wow!
They were not shooting blanks at you.
Jeez. That's insane. That boils on like torture.
Yeah. He said that was live ammunition. He said,
said,
when I tell you to crawl, they mean crawl.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Surprising, really. If you can open that up again and get it on the camera.
Sure, you can feel free to look. This is Sergeant Major Huff.
This fellow right here.
Let's see. I think I have.
What?
Looks like a nice man. I guess he wasn't.
Looks like he means business.
Yeah, he was.
Yes.
This is the citation from actually the researcher from the government for their service.
Yeah. You talked about like government's reach earlier. I was surprised that they weren't able to figure it out just based on the records, and you had to actually call them.
I was surprised that they, you know, I guess the Marines, so many of them moved around so many times, they probably didn't have address, they didn't know who the next of kin were, you know, there's probably a million different other factors that came into play, they didn't know how to contact them, and I just, like, I reached out to them, so if I hadn't have, we may not have ever made contact.
Yeah.
Did you know that the first black officer in the Marine Corps grew up in Rhinek?
No.
So that was,
wow.
Huh. Well, do you know his name?
I do. I have it somewhere. I can't tell you right now.
Okay.
I just happened to run across it in a newspaper article.
It's random.
And so it would have been... probably in the 50s, early 50s.
Right.
Maybe even later. But that was interesting, too. Yeah.
What brought you to, come on, let me ask, what brought you to get the book or meet the book?
The upcoming interview with you.
Okay.
I had never heard of the Marines of Montford Point.
I never had either, and I read a lot of World War II.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it definitely was interesting to learn about this other part of the Marine Corps history and another part of World War II.
You know, the gentleman who's really interesting is, what's his name? his name is Everhart. I forgot his. He was chief warrant officer with the Marine Corps.
Hmm.
And he was a former president of the Montfort Point Marines, because I think at one point they were actually trying to have a movie done about them.
That'd be interesting. They should honestly.
I don't know where that
ended up.
Where that ended up, or if it's still in the works. But they were trying to get a filmmaker on board. I think they had to do a movie about about their service. And now they have the memorial there, I believe, in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the most distressing things from this book were the blacks from the North who were coming into Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, and hit this blatant segregation. And even when they were in uniform, they would say to the person discriminating against them, I'm in the uniform of the American government. You know, I'm serving our country. And the person would say, well, I don't care. You know, and once in a while, the white Marine would intervene and say, just a second, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, I believe there was a story I've either read or heard about where there was a Marine on a bus.
I think I've heard this too. And then, like, they were told you to go to the back, and then a white Marine said...
Got to the point where the person would get confrontational, and the white Marine told him, I don't think that's something you want to do. And then it kind of... But... Yeah, it was that kind of thing that went on, I think, also burned my father. Even, as you mentioned, the GI Bill.
Yeah.
What they had to go through to get the benefits of the GI Bill.
Oh, really?
Oh,
really?
My goodness.
That's
just
awful.
Just getting home loans, and it was
school. Should have been something automatic, but it wasn't.
No,
yeah.
No.
Oh, that's awful.
Hmm.
No.
Jeez.
So... Yeah, we need to take heed, as my father would say all the time, you know, we need to learn something from it, and even in our current place in our history, we need to learn from what we're going through now, because if we don't, we're going to end up repeating some of the same things we've gone through before.
Which also in Europe right now is looking like it, without like the nationalist leaders.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
We need to really be mindful of what's going on around us, and that, you know, everybody has, should have the right and the opportunity to contribute in some way.
Yeah.
And once you deny that to a person, you're pretty much denying the civilian and the growth of your own nation.
Yeah.
And that's problematic.
Right.
That's really problematic.
I agree.
So hopefully we'll learn. I know you've probably learned about the Code Talkers.
Not in school particularly, but I have myself, the Navajo Code Talkers.
Did you watch the documentary at all?
No, I have not. I read a book on them.
I watched the movie.
Watch the documentary. It is out. If you can, I'll see if I can find it and send it to you.
Yeah.
Because that tradition, that Code Talkers, the Navajo Code Talkers tradition, they start when they were kids.
Yeah.
And they would have to repeat the story like, line for line, word for in the exact same order.
Yeah.
And I was just like, and then we'll go on and on. He said the stories would get longer and longer and longer.
And there's no way the Japanese could have decoded it because they don't have any Navajos in their nation.
No clue what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is fascinating. But see, once again, you know, these stories, everybody should know these stories.
Yes. These stories are like these people that did such great things are just not told enough.
Yeah, not told.
Yeah.
And not recognized.
No, I mean, in school we learned such a brief history of World War II, it's ridiculous.
Really?
It's more just like, okay, so like the major battles of like D-Day, Bulge, Stalingrad.
Right.
And then it's just like talking about like the lead up and like the aftermath and support. It's not as much about like the actual war and like the stories.
And the stories.
It's more the overview.
I was very fortunate, even going into... a lot of people in my family served in the military. They told me, you're going to college. Enough of that. Everybody's done that. You're going to college. But oddly enough, when I got to college in the program I was in, I had two mentors. And one who was a supervisor of the program I was in, and the other one I worked for, who were both military.
Mm-hmm.
this has nothing to do with the Marvin point, but
yeah.
I knew she was military, and I didn't know who she was until I got into a little situation, and she says, take a ride with me. And I said, what? She said, take a ride with me. So she took me to Griffiths Air Force Base,
okay,
upstate New York, and pulled into the grounds. When she got to the open, to the gate, she showed this guy this ID, and the guy snapped to attention and saluted her.
Jeez.
And then we got up, and I was just tarmac, and all these MPs were standing, and they all snapped to attention. I'm looking around like,
what the?
So the lesson that I got in a little bit of trouble I shouldn't have gotten into, and she said, next time you get in trouble, I'm going to bring you up here, and you can see how much trouble you can get into. But that's, turned out, she's my mentor. Her name was, she was retired Lieutenant Colonel C. Christine Johnson, the first female to command combat troops in Vietnam.
Wow.
Yeah.
I call her mom. But tough woman, but let me tell you, well, she's a sweetheart to me, but nobody knows her. Nobody knew
who she is. No,
she was in Who's Who. If you go to Who's Who in America, she's there. Yeah.
All of school is about the overview. It's nothing. It's not about stories. It's sad. You know.
Yeah. And but you know, and that's what we get into when we talk about education, teaching to test, and things like that. But that's what makes it interesting. It makes you want to learn it.
Exactly. No, I agree with that.
It
makes
it real to you.
Yeah.
You know, that makes it interesting.
It's not just numbers anymore.
Yeah, it's just not numbers. And then my other, she was with the Air Force, and then my other mentor was a Special Forces guy from the Air Force.
Wow.
So I had a lot of military oversight, even though I wasn't in the military. So, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.